Welcome to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for Larry Mantle. Later on today's show, we'll hear an interview with Netflix co-CEO and Chief Content Officer Ted Sarandos from the latest episode of John Horn's KPCC and LAS Studios podcast, Hollywood, the Sequel. They'll talk about how the streaming giant's production and business model might change when film and TV shoots ramp up in earnest again. Sarandos also explains how he sees Netflix's role in creating more space for storytellers of color. But first, joining us to review this week's new releases are Tim Cogshell, film critic for KPCC, Alt Film Guide, and Synagogues.com, and Amy Nicholson, film critic for KPCC, film writer for the New York Times, and host of the podcast Unspooled, right about to enter season two, I think, and the podcast miniseries Zoom. Amy and Tim, hello.
Hello.
Hello, Steven.
All right, you guys, we're going to begin with The Sound of Metal. It's a drama that stars Riz Ahmed, Olivia Cook, and Matthew Amalric. Darius Marder makes his directing debut and also co-wrote the screenplay with his brother Abraham. Tim.
Yeah, Riz is doing particularly amazing work in this very, very, very good film about a metal duo. He's the drummer, and Olivia Cook is the singer, and he is beginning to lose his hearing. This film opens with a performance, and Rez is playing the drums. Yes, it's very extended solo, while Ms. Cook is playing the guitar as loud as it can possibly be. When I started playing this film, I thought there was something wrong. It was so loud. No, there's nothing wrong. This is what they do across the arc of this film. I'm going to call out sound editor Nicholas Baker, supervising sound editor on this film, because it's because of him that this film works in the way it does. It's all about what we hear or don't hear or how we hear it as we fall into this character that Rez is playing, Ruben, who's losing his hearing. Mm-hmm. And of course, he's a drummer in a metal band. This is devastating to him. Not to mention just the nature of a metal guy. He's this hard rock metal guy with the short hair and the tattoos and all of that. And he's a manly, manly, manly man, but he's losing his hearing, the thing that drives him. And we follow him across the arc of the next few years of his life when he has to deal with what's happening to him as he slowly, slowly comes to understand what's going on and all that he tries to do to stop it, which is something that just can't be done.
And how do they capture, you know, the experience of one slowly going deaf in a film?
Well, this is why I call out Mr. Nicholas Baker. They do it very, very, in a very sort of objective sort of way, with the manipulation of the sound that we hear at any given moment. He's making a decision whether we're hearing the sound that Ruben is hearing, which can be muffled or can be incredibly loud after he has this operation, or can be so faint in the way that the sound moves around him, as opposed to when we're in the world of the other people that he's talking to, when suddenly the sound comes back in and we can hear conversations going on. It's just a fascinating way to make a film. It's an interesting backstory. You might get a chance to talk about it a little bit after Amy has her go, but I found it just really, really good work. If we're going to have an Academy Awards this year, certainly an Independent Spirit Awards this year,
I would
love for this film and particularly Rez's performance to be recognized.
It sounds like terrifying, like my worst nightmare. And also, as someone who loves a lot of metal as well, Amy, what do you think?
Yeah, this is a very stylish film that trusts a lot in how much we want to watch Riz Ahmed walk around, which turns out to be a lot. I mean, especially for people who love him in films like Nightcrawler, you know that he has this very singular intensity that is amazing to watch on screen. I don't know if I want to watch him walk around quite as much as this film pushes it towards the end. It does get a little long and it does lose focus a bit. But what it's really interested in under the surface is something that's really relatable. Like, how do you handle it when your plans for your life get dramatically changed? And especially when you're a bit implicated in the bad decisions that got you here. And another one of the motors that's happening under the surface is that Olivia Cook, his girlfriend, is very aware that Riz Ahmed is an ex-addict, that he's a person who's become one of those almost ultra healthy guys. You know, when you get sober, sometimes you get on this very like intense health kick, and
right.
She's worried about him backsliding and making decisions that are going to be self-destructive. And so one of the places this film goes is he visits a camp that is exclusively for the deaf. And it's interesting because like there you meet this camp head, who's an ex-Vietnam vet played by Matteo Amalric. And he's great in this role. Like, Matteo actually grew up as the son of deaf parents. And so he knows American Sign Language. He's a really convincing character who also plays in a metal band himself that performs in ASL. And the scenes there are kind of strange. I wonder how people will take them, because it almost presents this idea of a society only for the deaf as being a bit like a woodland cult. There are times when you're not quite sure where this movie is going to go yeah. that direction. But I do want to give just a really quick shout out to Olivia Cooke, who's a great actress that I think doesn't get enough interesting roles like this. And the character she plays, this really passionate feminist metalhead with an interesting background of her own. I mean, you understand why Riz Ahmed would do anything to get back to his life with her.
Yeah. Tim, we were talking before we started recording, and you said that it's based loosely on the real story of the members of the band Jucifer.
Yeah, yeah. Edgar Lifengood and Gazelle Amber Valentine, an actual couple that had a metal duo. And Edgar blew out his eardrums at a certain point in his career. Darius Martyr was the writer, one of the writers on The Place Beyond the Pines, a film made by Derek Cianfrance. Derek Cianfrance was making a film about Jucifer and Edgar and Gazelle, a sort of docudrama. Didn't quite finish it. Darius asked Derek if he could take that and sort of work it into this story, the story that we see here in this film. So it's what we see, but it's loosely based on Jucifer, on the band Jucifer, and what happened to Edgar after he blew out his eardrums.
Yeah, can't wait to see it. Sound of Metal, it's a drama from first-time director Darius Martyr. The film is rated R. You can see it on Amazon Prime Video. How about Boy State, the Apple TV and documentary film from directors Jesse Moss and Amanda McBain? They're making their feature directing debut here. The film profiles a week-long program in which 1,000 Texas high school seniors gather to build their own mock government, and it also follows several of the teens who participate. Amy.
This is an outstanding doc, and you're right. This is Amanda McBain's first documentary, but Jesse Moss, who co-directed it, also did The Overnighters, if people remember that really powerful documentary from a few years ago about this gold rush to be frackers in North Dakota that winds up getting a lot of people stranded and really exposes fault lines in a community. It's incredible. This is equally incredible. And yeah, the idea of Boy State is that it's a real thing where every year all of these boys get together to form a government, you know, complete with Supreme Court justices, governors, the political wheeler and dealers who arrange the campaigns. And the idea is that you don't have to run a government. You just have to convince everybody else to vote for you. You have to figure out whatever it takes to get the votes. And in that setup, when you have, you know, 1,100 boys, it does feel a lot like politics meets Lord of the Flies. But, the boys are really interested in things like whooping about masculinity and submission and freedom. And their ideas on complicated issues are pretty simplistic. You know, you meet a lot of guys who are libertarians with rich families, that sort of things, who buy thousands of dollars in Bitcoin and forget about it. You know, this is a literal boys club. But as it goes on, you know, the way you watch this government form, and it really gets into the speeches and the wheeling and dealing and the behind the scenes, it has you wondering how much politics really is like Lord of the Flies, if it is anything like this, because we watch coalitions form, break apart, and you watch people rise to the top of the system that, oh, it's just outstanding to watch. I don't want to spoil anything for it, but there are people in this film who, if they ever run for office, I will throw everything I have at helping them out. They are incredible.
Really?
And there are people that if they get anywhere near office, I will do everything I can to make sure they don't get anywhere near power. They are terrifying.
Wow. Well, I have a ton of questions. I won't ask them all, but Tim, you first, please.
Yeah, I like it as much as Amy does, and she's absolutely right. So Bill Clinton was a Boy State Arkansas participant. Dick Cheney was a Boy State participant too. So, you know, the spectrum exists there. This takes place at the University of Texas, Austin, 2018, right. Boy State is what this is. So we're in Texas. Amy's from Texas. But I can promise you that the fact that this particular boy state, there are girl states too, by the way, just so you know, this is all boys, but there are girl states, is in Texas. I think that matters here. Boy state came about in 1934 out of Illinois. I happen to know this because a few thousand years ago, I was in the Boy State, Missouri. And we went up to the University of Missouri in Central Missouri, and we did exactly what these boys are doing down there.
Wow.
So, like I said, it's been around since 1934. It was originally constructed to promote democracy, but specifically to counteract the sort of fascist principles that were taught to the Hitler Youth in Germany, that were being taught to so it came about for a very, very specific reason, and sort of developed into the sort of how we do mock government. What most of these boys at this particular Boy State at the University of Texas don't understand at all is government and what government is for. What they have are a lot of ideologies. And these are 16, 17-year-old boys. So basically what they're doing is parroting their parents' politics. So if their parents are right-wing conservative, that's what they're doing. Save this one kid whose last name happens to be Garza. This kid is fantastic. You know, the first generation American, mother was born in Mexico. He is the most rational, the most thoughtful, the most appropriately engaged young man that I've ever seen. I hope that I live long enough to see that man take the Oval Office.
Well, just one quick question and we'll move on. You know, Texas, of course, does lean conservative. It takes place in the state capital of Austin, which is a little bit more liberal, this kind of liberal bubble. So I presume that most of the kids kind of lean to the right.
Amy, what would be your call on that?
Well, I would say that the most interesting wrinkle is that one of the kids who has been very outspokenly right-wing, you know, very, very, very much speaking out against how we need to ban abortion, admits to the camera halfway through the film that he's actually liberal. He just assumes everybody else is conservative, and so he's willing to say whatever it takes to win.
Okay. Boy State is the documentary, co-directed by Jesse Moss and Amanda McBain, who makes her feature directing debut. The film is rated PG-13, and you can see it streaming on Apple TV+. Next, it's the comedic thriller called Spree. It stars Joe Keery of Stranger Things fame and Sashir Zamata. David Arquette also stars. The film is unrated and is directed by Eugene Kotlyarenko, who co-wrote the screenplay with Gene McHugh. I just saw the trailer. Blew my mind. Amy.
Yeah, I feel like as soon as I'm going to start describing this, everybody listening is going to be like, we've seen that a million times this year, because it feels like every month we get this thriller about kids who are too obsessed with social media fame and everything goes awry. I think we even did one the last time I was on the show. But this is the best one so far. The story here is that Joe Keery is playing a guy named Kurt who is grinding away at trying to get fame and can't get above 10 followers. And what he does for a living is he drives a car called Spree, which is like a company that's like Uber or Lyft basically here. And he covers the entire thing with cameras for when something good happens. And then escalates very fast to where, you know, you don't want to drink the water bottles in his car because something bad will happen to you. And it turns into kind of a King of Comedy situation when he becomes obsessed with a stand-up who gets into his car, who's played by actually a real life Sashir Zamata, who's a great stand-up comedian and podcast here in Los Angeles. I will say what makes this work for me is Joe Keery himself. He really plays this character in this kind of pitch perfect way. He's like charming and callous. Right. He acts dumb and friendly. He's in that way where he's able to shrug and say he doesn't know why people in his car are getting annoyed. He's both pathetic and terrifying, and he's very committed. You know, he's horrible and desperate, and he's naive and he's sad, and he's really engaging. And so it's fascinating to watch him. It's fascinating to watch how even the quote unquote good people in this film, like Zashir, are also calculating too in the way that they use social media, and they start to use social media against each other, like who can marshal fans. Mm-hmm. You know, you do know exactly where this film is going to head, but I was on board. You know, even the detours were fun for me.
Yeah, Tim.
Yes, Spree. Yeah, it's the name of the car company that he drives for in the thing. But, you know, generally speaking, we hear the word Spree. The other words that come to mind are crime and kill. So, you know, that's what we get here. The lead character, Joe, is playing here. He says it's simple. If you're not documenting yourself, you don't exist.
Right.
And I'm like, you know what? Pretty much sums up the zeitgeist of the day. It is good that this movie is funny because the kills in it are, you know, brutal, but couched in the context of humor, they're a little bit more tolerable for me. You have to spend a lot of time reading SMS messages going back and forth between him and his followers on the screen. So there's a circumstance of where you're looking at the screen and you're seeing what's going on. Very often we're looking at multiple cameras at one time, because he has cameras all over the place. This is all very clever, and it completely and totally works, but it does require a certain amount of effort. Sometimes I gave up.
Cool. Spree, it's the film starring Joe Keery and Sasheer Zamata. It's directed and co-written by Eugene Kotlo-Yurenko, and you can see it on multiple video and on-demand platforms. More previews just ahead on Film Week. When we return, we'll hear what our critics have to say about the documentary Skin, a history of nudity in the movies, and the Russian horror sci-fi film Sputnik. I'm Stephen Cuevas, in for Larry Mantle. Those reviews and more are just ahead on Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Stephen Cuevas, in for Larry Mantle, and we're joined by our Film Week critics, Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com, and Amy Nicholson, who writes on film for the New York Times and hosts the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom. Let's get on to our next film. It's Prevenge. It's a British horror comedy about first-time writer-director Alice Slough. Gemma Whelan, Kate Dickey, and Joe Hartley star. Amy, what you think?
So Prevenger is a portmanteau for pregnancy and revenge. It is a horror film about a pregnant woman played by Alice Slough herself, who not only writes and directs this film, but when she stars in this film and made it, she was in her third trimester of being pregnant herself, and she shot it for just 11 days for $100,000 in England. So it is a low-budget black comedy about a woman whose fetus is telling her to kill, 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 kill. The setup is that her partner, the father-to-be of her unborn child, has been killed in a climbing accident. And so part of it is that she's just really churning and swirling with all sorts of emotions and grief and flashbacks and trauma. But part of it is just that when you're a very noticeably pregnant woman, people come up to you with all sorts of advice that this film absolutely satirizes. You know, the idea of, oh, the baby will just tell you what to need. You just need to listen to the baby's spirit. Your life is about making this baby happy now. And this baby is in a feathery whisper telling her to kill everybody. And so this is very much just a comedy with bits of gore. And it's done in that really kind of flat-footed style of British comedy. Alice Slough herself, she was in Bandersnatch, the Black Mirror show. And it's just got that very deadpan sense of humor. It's rare, I think, to see a comedy, or it's rare to see a horror film with such a feminine point of view. You know, horror films have typically starred women at the end, you know, girls mm-hmm. in bikini tops who are running around and stabbing people. But this is the rare horror film that is just solidly, completely feminine in point of view, you know, the things that it finds funny and takes awareness of, the things that motivate it. And it's really interesting to watch in that direction. And I think the more it gets interested in her flashbacks of her trauma and kind of figuring out her emotional problems, it loses a lot of momentum. But it's a short film. It gets in and out in 80 minutes, and it's a really fun debut from Alice Slough. Like, I'm excited to see where she goes after this.
Yeah, sounds great. The film is Prevenge, written and directed by Alice Slough. It's unrated and available to rent and buy on video on demand platforms, including iTunes, Amazon Prime Video, and more. Next up, it's Skin, a history of nudity in the movies. It's a documentary directed by Danny Wolfe. It explores film's complicated relationship with nudity and how it's been used to both empower and exploit actors through history. It features interviews with actors like Pam Grier, Malcolm McDowell, Shannon Elizabeth, and more. Tim, sounds fascinating. What you think?
It very much is fascinating. Malcolm McDowell got naked early in his career in a film called If. Bruce Davidson in this film, who got naked real early in his career, his very first film, as a matter of fact, last summer. So what this film does is literally explore the history of nudity in Hollywood movies from the beginning of cinema, because people started getting naked for cameras really like first day.
Yes.
And frankly, before that, when it was just photography, once images could be carved on walls. It was naked people. It has always been this way, and it's certainly true of cinema as well. So by the decade, we walk across the history of films and we talk about this. We talk about it in terms of the pre-code era, the code era, and the post-code era. which is all very, very interesting, particularly the way it is explained to us by several film historians in the context of this movie, as well as all those people that you were just talking about. Interesting thing about this movie, Skin, A History of Nudity, is that it's full of nudity. It's just naked.
I would hope so, Tim.
You would. It's a funny sort of thing. So if you've never seen Hedy Lamarr in a pre-code a nude scene that she did, you can see her. You can see it in this movie. Within the context of the film, this is all just being explored and chronologically and walked through. However, we are in the sort of Me Too movement, post-Me Too movement. So that has to be spoken to in the context of this film, too. Otherwise, what we're really doing is not being particularly judgmental about any of this. We're just simply documenting the history of it all the way up to the present day. But because of Me Too, that is discussed in the context of the film as well.
Yeah, good. Amy.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the weaker stretches of this documentary that is really terrifically full, I mean, of everything you could see. There will be a point where even you listening right now who think this won't happen, you will become numb to the sight of naked men and women. Mm-hmm. You'll just be like, oh, there's another one. That's fine. Here we go. I find the interesting stretch where we're talking about pre-code stuff very solid in that, you do have all of these film experts coming in and talking about like the political battles behind the scenes. Then there's kind of a stretch where it feels like we're listening to the guy from Mr. Skin just list off every time you see breasts in film, which is a lot. The film kind of struggles to find a good tone with him. Is it leering or are we really going to talk more about the politics? Where I thought this film got exceptionally strong is when the actors and actresses themselves and the directors like Martha Coolidge start to take over. To hear Martha Coolidge talking about the deals she had to make in the 70s and 80s, for things like Valley Girl, where they're like, you need this many sets of breasts. And the actresses who are being told, well, you're going to have to be one of the sets of breasts. And when they start to have their own voice in this, to talk about how they were two-timed by their agents behind their back, or how their films like Heckerling, having her film re-edited in Fast Times at Ridgemont High when they didn't want to show the male nudity, so they made the film lose its point that she was trying to make about the awkwardness of this first time virginity scene. And you realize how much kind of happened behind the scenes. Even Malcolm McDowell gets into this. He jokes about being the most naked man in film, but then he gets to grumble about how his Caligula was hijacked by Bob Guccione and then edited XXX scenes into places where he thought he was just looking at a bird, but now he's not looking at a bird. He's like appreciating a hardcore sex scene. And so, I mean, it is as thorough as it gets. It is, I guess, like being in a Volkswagen bus with 10,000 naked people. Like, you will really come away feeling like you have seen and learned it all. Yeah. So I appreciate this. And I think, honestly, for me, one of my favorite parts was that the head of the MPAA is also in there speaking a lot about how they have judged nudity throughout the years. And when she talks about the debate about the topless scene in Titanic, I was just riveted.
Hmm. Well, speaking of bodies or body horror, Sputnik, it's a Russian sci-fi. Actually, let me wrap up on Skin here. We were talking about Skin, A History of Nudity in the Movies. I should have said it's directed by Danny Wolfe and the film is unrated, even though there's tons of nudity. And you can see it on video and on-demand platforms, including Fandango Now and iTunes. As I was saying, the Russian sci-fi horror film Sputnik is directed by Igor Abramenko, who makes his feature directing debut. Tim.
Yeah, I'm still giggling about the unrated film full of nudity. Sputnik, yeah, man. So this is sort of like Solaris meets Alien. So it has the sensibility of Tarkovsky. But it has the sort of rage and thriller aspects of Ridley Scott, this movie. You have these cosmonauts. It's all set in 1983. They're up there. Something sort of happens. We don't know exactly what. They make it back to Earth. One of them's dead. The other one has to be put in isolation. Meanwhile, we have this doctor. She's sort of a rebel. And she does this thing that she's not supposed to do to save this kid's life. And she's getting ready to get kicked out of the profession. So this general, this Russian general, goes and gets her and brings her out to interview this cosmonaut who came back, who they're keeping in quarantine. She doesn't really understand what the heck is going on. The cosmonaut doesn't really understand what the heck is going on. We eventually, very, very quickly, actually figure out what's going on. So that part about it being part alien, part Ridley Scott's Alien, the big scene in that movie, of course, is when that alien bursts through the body of, I think it's John Hurt, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Well, this guy, he has an alien in him. He's not going to come busting out of his chest, but he gets out of him every night. And that's what this movie is about. what we're going to do about the symbiotic relationship between this alien, this inside this cosmonaut, and exactly what's going to happen to the rest of the world.
Oh, this is my favorite subgenre of like sci-fi movies. Amy.
I have to admit, I found this movie a little bit generic. You know, the most interesting thing about it is seeing this idea of, you know, the pretty stern neuropsychologist who's going to go her own, who's going to be a little bit rogue, who's, you know, stubborn and outspoken, to see how that personality trait doesn't do as well in the Soviet Union as, you know, the kind of characters I think she's ripping off a bit. You know, there's a, definitely a touch of Jodie Foster and Silence of the Lambs in here. And also Ripley, of course. But the difference is, you know, like Ripley gets mad at corporations and she's able to try to get mad at the Soviet mindset, or at least the assumptions she makes about how the Soviets and her bosses and the general will react to her opinions and her take on the situation. You know, she's able to really put this into a different, you know, headspace that lets this kind of generic alien film play out in a slightly more interesting register. I have to say, as for the alien himself, I am really tired of these like slithery monster things that just screech a lot. We really need new creature animation. I'm so tired of this alien look. And I will say that like then the film gets a little bit more into this subplot about the astronaut's life that he left behind before he went into space. That was fine. I wasn't so pulled into the emotions. I think what appealed to me about this film, if there's a reason to watch it, is kind of just the cold mindset of which it takes on a genre that we know very well.
And the alien, it's naked?
It's very naked and very shiny.
Sputnik is the film. It's from director Igor Abramenko. It's unrated, and you can see it on video on demand platforms, including Google Play, iTunes, and Vudu. Next up, it's Jazz on a Summer's Day. It's a remastering of a classic 1959 concert film, considered one of the first of its kind ever made. It's directed by Aram Avakian and Bert Stern. And if you don't know, it captures performances from greats like Louis Armstrong, Dinah Washington, and the great Chuck Berry at the 1958 Newport Jazz Festival in Rhode Island. Tim.
Yeah, Jazz on a Summer's Day. What we're actually watching is the 1958 Newport Jazz Festival. The film came out in 1951.
Right.
This has all been restored, and it's just absolutely beautiful. The color is saturated. It's wonderful. These extraordinary performances from everyone that you mentioned, including Mahalia Jackson and Dinah Washington. My favorite was Anita O'Day and the Oscar Peterson Quartet. She performs Old Devil Moon and Georgia Brown and Tea for Two. And she's just so elegant. She has on this black hat and this black A-line dress, and these white gloves. And it's an exquisite return look at a period that's sort of long gone, along with a good deal of this music. Bert Stern and Avram, they were commercial and fashion photographers, which is one of the reasons why this film looks a little bit differently than you know, other docs of the day, generally speaking, because they had a different sense of what they found beautiful. We're not always looking at the performers on the stage. We're in the crowd. And the other thing I love about this movie is that this is such an integrated crowd that we're watching at this jazz festival. Everyone is there. They're all together. Rich and poor, black and white, and they're all doing one thing. They're bobbing their heads and tapping their feet to this extraordinary music that's happening on the stage at any given moment.
Yeah, great stuff. Timeless. Jazz on a Summer's Day is the film directed by Aram Avakian and Bert Stern. It's unrated, and you can see it at Lamley's Virtual Cinema and the Frida Virtual Cinema. Next up, we got Project Power. It's a Netflix original film starring Jamie Foxx and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Henry Joost and Ariel Schumann are the directors, and Mattson Tomlin is the writer. Tim.
So this is a good, solid action drama, for my money. Neato premise with a diverse and energetic cast. And it's set in NOLA, set in New Orleans, which is also good. You know, it's not set in L.A. and New York. So I like all of that that's going on. So what we have here is this wacky, glowing pill that is the new thing in the market. And what it can do is give people superpowers for just a little while, so that they can go do some crime. Now, this pill might just kill you. You never really know what's going to happen to you when you take this pill. You got Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who's playing this cop, who's willing to do the thing that he has to do in order to crack this drug ring and stop these people, which means that he's willing to take that pill. Not supposed to, but it does it anyway. Jamie Foxx is this ex-soldier who's looking for his daughter, who's been kidnapped by these people, and we come to realize why everybody wants his daughter. And then you have this little black girl who's kind of a dealer of this drug, but she's also in league with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, the cop, to try to do some good if she can. So we have these three. And man, once this thing gets rolling and the special effects kick in, because every time somebody takes a pill, something wacky is going to happen. Yeah. It really does become a heck of a roller coaster ride. It doesn't all actually make any sense, but that's okay. I didn't really mind that so much. This is from Henry Joost and Ariel Schulman, the Catfish guys. I think they did a whole bunch of those Paranormal Activity movies, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, yeah. I had a doggone good time with it. I thought it was a hoot.
Amy, got about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
I mean, this film is nonsense. The idea is that these powers all come from different animal DNA, which when you start to try to make sense with that, makes no sense. But you do get this powerful scene where Jamie Foxx talks about how he has the powers of pistol shrimps and how pistol shrimps are the most powerful animal on the planet. So I will say thank you to this film. And it's very over the top New Orleans, everything, mentioning the saints every 2 minutes to make sure we know where this is located. Because after this film, while I was still making fun of it for days, I did go get shrimp po' boys. And that was the best part.
Project Power, it's available to stream on Netflix. It stars Jamie Foxx and Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and it's rated R. Coming up on Film Week, we'll hear an excerpt from the latest episode of the KPCC and LAS Studios podcast, Hollywood, the sequel. This week, it's Netflix co-CEO and chief content officer Ted Sarandos joining John Horn to talk about how the pandemic has changed production for the mega streamer and why he thinks major theater chains are missing out by refusing to show Netflix films. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for Larry Mantle, and you're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app.